As soon as the assembly, etc., of the first pair of Spitfires was complete, our friends from the Marine Craft section brought an empty lighter to the slipway as before, and the two Spitfires were manhandled aboard and secured for the sea trip round to a suitable spot near the runway at North Front. The runway in those days didn't project as far into the sea as it does now. At North Front, the compasses were swung, the aircraft air-tested, including the firing of armament, and when declared serviceable, were on readiness as standby fighter defence Gibraltar. When the next pair were assembled, they would follow the same routine and would then be made available to replace the first pair, and so on. I don't recall any occasion when their services were called for. To try to confuse the enemies in Algeciras, it was arranged for a lighter with two Spitfires aboard to be tied up to a buoy out in the anchorage, and as the aircraft ex-North Front became available, they would be moved out on lighters and then onto Eagle at night, always ensuring that there were two aircraft left on a lighter before daybreak at the usual buoy in the anchorage. Thus it was hoped that the spies would not know how many Spitfires had been loaded onto Eagle. When the 16 were completed and the last pair loaded again in the dark, Eagle sailed on March the 20th, leaving the fighter defence of Gibraltar to take care of itself. And according to my notes, we flew the first flight off in the morning of the 21st of March, with a delay in seeing the rest of them. I can't recall the details. Of course, on return to Gib, we were again addressed by Wing Commander McLean, who had to apologise again, as we were expected to continue, and the batch size increased to the extent that, in addition to what could be accommodated in the hangar deck of Eagle, we would sail with a number lashed down on the flight deck. We kept this up through the rest of March, April, May and June. On his way home at the end of his tour as AOC Malta, we were addressed by Air Marshal Hugh Lloyd, who thanked us not only for the work we had done, but for the various bundles of goodies, cigarettes, etc., which we had asked the pilots to deliver to the boys on the island. As the months passed, our usual practice when preparing to fly off was to have as many aircraft on the round down, aft end of the flight deck, and start up each aircraft in turn. The pilot would taxi forward to line up on the centre line, with Wing Commander McLean beside the cockpit, checking the setting of prop pitch controls, then with four bods on the tail and two lying on the deck holding the chocks in, a run-up. On receipt of a signal, all the bods got off, chocks out, tail up, brakes off, and away she went. I can still sense the heat from the flight deck. Eventually, as the summer progressed, reduced wind speed over the flight deck at takeoff presented problems. The flaps on the Spitfire were either up or down, and always remained up at takeoff. It was concluded that a small amount of flap at takeoff would improve lift, so a method of setting takeoff flap was devised using blocks of wood of appropriate shape. The procedure was to arrange, whilst each aircraft was being prepared for flight, to lower the flaps, the wooden blocks inserted in the wing trailing edge flap shroud, and the flaps selected up. This trapped the blocks to hold the flaps at what was found to be the optimum position for takeoff. After getting his aircraft airborne and at a safe height and speed, the pilot selected flaps down, which allowed the blocks to drop away, so that with flaps and undercarriage up, he had a clean aircraft. The Spitfire's performance on takeoff in the conditions prevailing in the Med during the summer also featured during the preparations for the latter reinforcement operations in support of Pedestal, the August 1942 convoy. Several batches, up to 32 at a time, were handled up to the end of June without loss, as far as I know. There was one which developed an internal glycol leak or similar, which warranted a ferry back to Gibraltar, so Wing Commander McLean tried his hand at a carrier takeoff quite successfully and landed the aircraft back at North Front for an engine change. The American carrier USS Wasp joined in, although I wasn't on Eagle to witness the joint operations. We didn't all go down the Mediterranean on every trip. About the end of June, we were joined by a crowd of new lads out from England, intended to supplement our efforts, but by dint of some persuasion from Wing Commander McLean and Shorty Hughes, the powers that be agreed that the new lads could be used to replace the equivalent numbers of the original Special Operations Maintenance Party, who had been given to understand that they were on a 6 weeks detachment and not on an overseas posting. So those originals, who had compassionate grounds to offer as a reason to return home, were first considered, and the names of the rest by trade and rank were put in the hat and the appropriate numbers drawn out to indicate who went home. I was one of those to have his name drawn out. I should think we were originally about 70 strong, and about half of those sailed with me on the troop ship Narkunda on the 6th of June 1942 with a Ford destroyer escort. Among our fallen passengers were a number of RAF aircrew who had been shot down and escaped by various routes through Europe down to Gib, assisted by the escape organisation. We also had some of the seriously wounded from Malta who had either been flown out or brought out on the Royal Naval vessels that did the high-speed dash from Gibraltar to Malta and back, like mine layers HMS Welshman and HMS Manxman, I believe. We anchored in the Clyde on the 12th of July and travelled by train, etc., down to Cranfield overnight and went straight on 7 days' leave. On return, we joined 3501 servicing unit at Cranfield, which was just forming to carry out major servicing on obsolescent marks of Spitfires and Bowfighters withdrawn from squadrons as new marks became available, the old marks being required for use in the operational training units, etc. Within 10 days of our return from leave, about two-thirds of those who had been with SOMP were warned that we might be required for overseas, and by the 30th of July, we were back at RAF West Kirby preparing again for the boat. We moved off by coach and then by train on the evening of August the 1st for another unknown destination. Of course, there were a few among us that took a dim view of another overseas posting without leave. Dolly Gray, I remember, had tried to get taken off before we left Cranfield, even insulting the flight sergeant cook in the airman's mess, expecting to be put on a charge and thus to be held back, but Chiefy was too wily to fall for that one. Dolly had compassionate reasons for staying in the UK and pursued them at each opportunity, and when we left West Kirby, his case was still under review. As we got onto the train at Lime Street Station in Liverpool, Dolly had just about given up hope when a Royal Air Force police corporal came along the platform calling for LAC Grey. Dolly was not coming with us after all. I think it was his father who was very ill and died shortly after. We eventually reached RAF Abbotsinch, or was it Royal Naval Air Station Abbotsinch, during the morning of Sunday the 2nd of August, stayed for a meal and then moved on to Gourock to embark on the aircraft carrier HMS Furious. The Clyde seemed pretty full of merchant ships and naval vessels of various shapes and sizes. HMS Furious was different from Eagle, having two hangar decks, one above the other, and unlike Eagle, which had a smokestack incorporated in the island, Furious smoke dispersed through a sort of matrix in the aft end of the flight deck. She had been loaded with about 40 Spitfires before we went aboard. To get the maximum aircraft on, they had skated Spitfires sideways into the two hangar decks and lashed them down. We had not seen Wing Commander McLean or Squadron Leader Hughes since leaving Gib, as far as I can remember, and we soon found our new engineering officer was Flight Lieutenant Cassells. We didn't have any time to settle down, just dumped kit and started work. We found that all propellers and constant speed units had to be removed and crated before we sailed. It seemed that de Havilland hydromatic propellers as installed would not provide the best takeoff performance from Furious. I don't know how the flight deck length of Furious compared with Eagle, but I've since learned that an early form of ski jump was incorporated in Furious, providing an upward inclination towards the bow that was not readily discernible. There was no time to reposition the aircraft in the hangars, so the removal of the props was undertaken in what space was available. In some cases, this was just sufficient to lift the spinner off without hitting the adjacent bulkhead or hangar wall or whatever in the hangar decks. The props were manhandled off and lowered to the deck to be slid on odd bits of timber under the other aircraft, etc., onto the lift. The replacement rotol props were brought on board from lighters shortly after we got on board. They were already assembled and still in those enormous Y-shaped crates. As soon as the crates started to come aboard, the prop was removed and laid on the flight deck. As each de Havilland prop came up on the lift, it was stowed in the empty crate and loaded back onto the lighter. As soon as every DH prop in its crate was over the side, we were expected to sail. And this work took us through the rest of August the 2nd and 3rd, which was the bank holiday, and the 4th. The hangars were really hot and we really sweated. In the meantime, a lot of the shipping had gone, most of it, I think, shortly after we got aboard Furious on the 2nd. We sailed in the early hours of the 5th, knowing that we had the props and CSUs to fit at sea. By the 6th of August, fresh water was short and the heat in the hangar was terrific. On the 7th, Flight Lieutenant Cassells got into a panic as the work was behind schedule and we had to sweat blood. I don't think we had much by way of body fluids to use by that time. At some stage, we were told that Furious and her escort should have sailed with the rest of the shipping we had seen in the Clyde, but sailing had been delayed due to the propeller change saga.